Welcome to this special Christmas week edition of Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We hope this season brings you joy, warmth, and cherished moments with loved ones. Happy holidays. Coming up today, Matt Olien will reveal his favorite movies of 2024, and Danielle Webster will share a heartwarming story about her great-grandma Maud's butterscotch pie. It's a treasured family tradition. But first, one of my favorite conversations of the year. Kevin Fidarko's book, A Walk in the Park, recounts he and Pete McBride's incredible journey on foot across the Grand Canyon. Since its publication, it has received widespread acclaim, including winner of the 2024 National Outdoor Book Award in Outdoor Literature, shortlisted for the 2025 Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Nonfiction, and it's been named a Best Book of the Year by the New York Times, Airmail, the Smithsonian Magazine, and Financial Times. Here's my conversation that we aired earlier this year with Kevin. Kevin, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to begin, I think, by asking you who Colin Fletcher was.
Colin Fletcher is referred to by people who know him as the godfather of backpacking. Born in Wales, came to the United States, and in the summer of 1963, undertook a remarkable journey, which involved traversing with a backpack on foot the length of what was at the time Grand Canyon National Park. During those years, the borders of Grand Canyon National Park embraced only about a little more than a third of Grand Canyon itself. But he wrote a book, the title of which is The Man Who Walked Through Time. Fletcher's account of the landscape he traversed, the experiences that he underwent inside of that abyss, they were all contained in the pages of this book, but one of the most prominent and, for me, salient features of it was a photograph he took of himself that was emblazoned on the cover. It captures him standing with his back to the viewer, backpack on his back, a stout walking stick in his hand, gazing across this ocean of bare naked rock, this giant hole in the ground with a very thin blue ribbon of water running along its bottom. And my father, back in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, handed me a copy of that book when I was 10 or 11 years old. The image itself transfixed me, planted a seed in my mind, and I determined at some point after picking it up for the first time that I was going to have to find a way to get from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to the Grand Canyon.
How did you then decide to, with your friend Pete, to walk through the park?
Well, that's a story that really begins in the early 2000s when I went to the Grand Canyon for the very first time. I was enrolled in what was called a wilderness first responder course, which is designed to impart the rudiments of emergency backcountry medicine, which I felt I needed at the time because I was working as a freelance magazine writer and traveling all over the world to some rather exotic and remote places. And I walked into a boathouse in Flagstaff, Arizona, and my jaw just hit the floor. I found myself staring at this diminutive navy of small wooden rowboats known as Grand Canyon dories. And something about those boats, the simplicity, the austerity, the beauty of their lines, the bright colors they were painted in that made them look like floating Easter eggs, the paintings that were affixed to their transoms depicting birds and animals of the desert Southwest, all of that crystallized in my mind. I was determined to find a way to follow those boats into the hidden world of whitewater at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. I did so. I spent the better part of six seasons struggling as an apprentice river guide, discovered a story there about three river guides who put a little wooden dory into the Colorado River in the spring of 1983 and used a historic flood as a kind of hydraulic slingshot to propel them through the canyon faster than anyone had done in history. Wrote a book called The Emerald Mile that chronicles that world. And then in the summer of 2015, shortly after that book was published, my good friend and collaborator, Peter McBride, a National Geographic photographer and filmmaker, came to me with a rather harebrained idea. And he said, look, I know that you are familiar with the world of whitewater at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, but what we're going to do is an assignment for National Geographic. We are going to strap 55-pound backpacks on our backs, and we're going to walk from one end of Grand Canyon National Park to the other, despite the fact that there's no trail. And that's how this project originated.
What were you thinking when he brought that idea to you?
I was thinking two things. The first, and the one that I should have stuck with, was this is absolutely crazy and no way am I going to do this. The best and easiest and most enjoyable way to traverse the canyon is to follow the only highway that makes any sense, the Colorado River, the instrument that carved and created and polished and sculpted the canyon in the first place, and that affords a marvelous way to move through the landscape by allowing you to pilot boats through it. And so, but at the same moment, you know, I was aware of something that Pete knew about too. The central character in the book that I had written, the man who originated the idea of conducting this speed run in a little wooden dory through the Grand Canyon, a book called The Emerald Mile, his name was Kenton Grua. And in the spring of 1983, as I mentioned, they set this historic speed record. But 5 years prior to that, Kenton Grua had done something that arguably was much more difficult and a much more important achievement. He had figured out how to become the first person in modern recorded history to walk through the Grand Canyon. And Pete knew that despite how crazy the idea was, I would find it irresistible to literally follow in the footsteps of this man who I had written one book about, but whose true achievement remains something of a mystery to me.
Grand Canyon, of course, incredible natural history, and that's really a significant part of your narrative. What are some surprising facts that you discovered, A, in your research, but B, in your experience?
Here are two things that are kind of interesting. The first, and this will give you an idea of how broken and convoluted the landscape inside the canyon actually is. The Colorado River, which I just mentioned a moment ago, that river travels 277 miles as it moves from the eastern gateway at the head of Grand Canyon, a place known as Lee's Ferry, all the way to the Grand Wash Cliffs, which form the canyon's western terminus. If you were on foot moving through that landscape, traveling through the canyon in a linear fashion, you will spend so much time and so many miles moving up and down the walls of the canyon, piecing together a route that will enable you to traverse often very, very thin cliff ledges and terraces. And you will spend so many miles taking mandatory detours into what we call side canyons, tributary canyons that extend off of both sides of the main stem canyon, more than 600 of them. You'll spend so much time embarked on these kind of detours that you will traverse not 277 miles, but 750 miles. And the walls of the canyon, these are mile-high ramparts of rock comprised of terraces and cliffs that extend from the edges of the Colorado River to the rims of the canyon. There's 6,000 feet of vertical distance. There's so much temperature gradient between the tops of the canyon and the bottom of the canyon that the life forms that proliferate at the rims of the canyon, particularly the North Rim, the highest point in the canyon, 6,000 feet above the Colorado River. This is an environment, that's a subalpine environment. You'll find aspen trees and conifers like Douglas firs. You'll find rough grouse and black bear and meadows filled with wildflowers in the summertime. And as you move down the walls of the canyon, as the air becomes hotter and water becomes more scarce, you'll move through a succession of ecozones until you find yourself at the bottom surrounded by vegetation and animals that populate the Sonoran Desert. You will traverse such a range of flora and fauna that you will journey from what is the equivalent of the types of plants and animals that you would see in central Canada to the types of plants and animals that you would see in northern Mexico. And what the canyon does is it takes those 2,000 miles of linear distance, flips it vertically, and compresses it into a single vertical mile, and then compresses all of the life forms and ecosystems that you find across that 2,000-mile distance into the canyon itself. It's a remarkable landscape. There's no place like it, and it's the single most iconic national park in America because of that.
We're enjoying our conversation with Kevin Fedarko. He's written a new book, A Walk in the Park. It's a compelling narrative that intertwines adventure, humor, and the harsh realities of the natural world. It recounts he and his friend Pete McBride's attempt to traverse the Grand Canyon on foot, a journey fraught with unexpected challenges and revelations. Let's talk about the challenges first. Humorous ones we read about, cactus, anthills, I'm sure there are many others.
Yes, there are. I have to say that I'm embarrassed, but it's the truth and I can't pretend otherwise. Pete and I thought we knew what we were getting into. I mean, I'd written an entire book in the bottom of the canyon. I figured how hard could it actually be? And we did not prepare adequately for our journey. We didn't bring the right gear. We weren't in the type of physical shape that we needed to be in. We had not done a very good job figuring out what our route was going to be. And as a result, we suffered terribly, particularly during the first of what would turn out to be 8 back-to-back expeditions inside the canyon. We started out in the fall of 2015 amidst a very substantial late summer, early autumn heat wave in which the temperatures were around between 105 and 110 degrees at night. Within a couple of days, my feet were covered in so many blisters, it looked as if I'd been given a pedicure with a belt sander. And Pete had succumbed to a heat-related condition, very serious condition called hyponatremia, resulting from a deficiency of electrolytes that can, if you're not careful, kill you. And so that marked the beginning of what turned out to be a litany of hardship and suffering that accompanied us from our first steps to our last steps inside the canyon, but was also punctuated by moments of wonder and revelation and epiphany and magic.
And I assume it's all of that, the wonder, the epiphany, the magic that kept you coming back for more, so to speak?
It did. The canyon has a way, as many powerful landscape features do, as I assume there are landscape features in your part of the world to which people become affixed. The canyon has a way of sinking its teeth and its claws into you and refusing to let go. And once you find yourself in its grasp, despite the punishment that it is capable of administering, the gifts that it offers up, both in terms of experience and insight, are so powerful and compelling that you find yourself continuously coming back for more.
Kevin, you wrote about the emotional experience of seeing your dad undergo chemotherapy and how it deeply impacted you. Can you elaborate on how witnessing his journey maybe influenced your own personal and emotional journey when you were on this incredible expedition?
I don't think I really fully understood this when Pete and I started our walk, but as I began to write the book, I realized that my journey through the canyon did not begin at Lee's Ferry, the eastern gateway to Grand Canyon, where we started walking. It began back in Pittsburgh when I was 10 years old and my father handed me that copy of Colin Fletcher's book that you asked me about a moment ago, and the seed that that planted in my mind. And in some ways, I think my journey to the canyon and then through the canyon represented a kind of affirmation and completion of dreams that my father, I think, had about experiencing natural beauty, about going to some of the great landscapes of the American West, and that he was never able to do. It's terribly sad, but, you know, my dad had been diagnosed with cancer, the cancer that eventually would kill him, just before I began my journey through the Grand Canyon. And he was only able to follow that journey in the form of conversations and phone calls and photographs that I shared with him. But the knowledge of my connection to him and his interest and the fact that I was completing a dream that was not only mine but his, that was part of the baggage that I carried with me inside my backpack, along with my camp stove and my sleeping bag and the dehydrated food that Pete and I were eating for dinner each and every night. I wasn't aware of the fact that it was there until I started writing the story. And one of the most salient aspects of the whole thing is that, you know, one of my goals when we completed this journey was to finish this book, to write fast enough that my dad would be able to hold the book in his hands and read it before he passed away. And I couldn't do that. I couldn't write faster than my father's death. It took me 7 years to write this book, but my great friend Pete, he was able to complete a coffee table photograph book.
He is a great photographer, by the way.
He's a marvelous photographer and a very, very gifted filmmaker as well. And he did a documentary film called Into the Canyon and this coffee table book called Between the River and the Rims. And my father was able to hold his book, Pete's book, in his hands, sitting in front of the fireplace, and paged through the best of the images that Pete took during the entire year that Pete and I spent inside the canyon, and relive that experience, thanks to Pete, on the final Christmas before he died.
Tell me more about your friendship with Pete. You are going through an incredible, physically and emotionally demanding journey that has many ups and many downs as well. Oftentimes, those kinds of relationships don't survive that kind of pressure, if you will. Tell me about how your friendship with Pete's evolved and has evolved, especially post-expedition until today even.
I mean, Pete and I have a very odd and interesting connection, and our relationship has both devolved and evolved over the years. You know, we've worked together for the better part of the past 20 years. We've gone on magazine assignments to some rather exotic and remote parts of the world, places like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, the Caucasus Mountains, the Horn of Africa, Everest Base Camp. Each and every one of those assignments wound up being a kind of a disaster, a debacle in one form or the other, largely because Pete had thought these ideas up without really kind of doing his homework, and because the two of us did not do enough preparation. And so we have a history of moving into and getting in over our heads. And we did that many times before this project in the Grand Canyon. And I think in some ways, it set up a theme that was very familiar to us as we struggled across that the arc of that summit 150-mile journey inside the canyon. But it also meant that Pete and I, by the time we embarked on our misadventure in the canyon, had been through a great deal together, and we knew that despite how much trouble we might get ourselves into, despite the mistakes that we might commit both separately and together, that each of us could rely absolutely and completely on the other. Our trust in one another was complete, and it remains so to this day. Arduous, gorgeous, natural landscapes, public lands, national parks, national monuments, they have a way of both testing and strengthening the bonds between people when they go into these places together. And that is one reason why I feel very strongly at the end of this journey that although so many of us think of experiencing nature as something that we do in a solitary manner, particularly if we've read writers like Henry David Thoreau or Edward Abbey or John Muir, most Americans experience our greatest natural wonders as a communal experience. We do it with the people we love. We do it with our families. And we come out of those places better and closer than when we went into them because of that.
Is that the message you want readers to take away from your experience and your writing of A Walk in the Park?
That's one of two messages I'd like to take them to take away. The other is that, you know, Craig, it's not necessary to strap a giant pack on your back and spend more than a year stumbling through the most inaccessible reaches of a place like Grand Canyon to touch or be touched by the wonders of this national park or any of our national parks. The writer Wallace Stegner once said that part of the power of wilderness and part of the reason why it is incumbent on us as Americans to preserve and protect it and pass it along intact to future generations, to our children and our children's children, is that part of its power resides in the fact that you don't necessarily have to move into the heart of wilderness to be affected by it. Sometimes it is enough simply to step to the edge and look in. Sometimes it's enough simply to know that it's there. And there are 6 million people each and every year who drive into the main entrance of Grand Canyon National Park, who do not hike, who do not boat, who don't ride mules down to the canyon. They simply stand along the rim. They find a place that's quiet. They watch the sunrise. They watch the sunset. They take in the silence and the stillness of all of that rock and all of that air and all of that light, and they walk away changed in some way. And that experience is available to each and every person who takes the trouble to simply visit our national parks.
Very well that you encourage folks to do that. I grew up just about an hour and a half away from Grand Teton and Yellowstone National Park, and had many of those experiences, certainly, that you're just talking about there. Kevin, before we go, the Grand Canyon has rich human history as well. And did learning stories of those who came before you there influence your journey and your writing?
Absolutely. And I realize I'm remiss because there's not two things I'd like to take readers away. There are three, and you're touching on the third. I'm embarrassed to say that when I went into the canyon with Pete, I was unaware of the importance and the richness of stories of people who are connected to this landscape, whose relationship to it far predates that of people like myself, who are the descendants of white settlers who populated the American West in the 19th century. Prior to the time in which we set aside this canyon and declared it to be a national park and put a fence up around it to protect it from incursion, from development, from ruination, it was populated by people who considered that their home and who had lived there not just for hundreds, but for thousands of years. There are 11 Native American tribes whose ancestral lands either abut or lie directly inside of what is now Grand Canyon National Park. And part of the myth that we tell ourselves as Americans about our national parks is that we demonstrated the sagacity and the wisdom as a society to recognize these places of great natural beauty and set them aside and preserve them for future generations of Americans. But we neglect to mention, we tell ourselves a lie about the fact that when we set these places aside, we had to exile the people who considered it their home and were there already. And those people are not only an important and an essential part of the past in these landscapes, but they're very much a part of the present and the future. Those 11 Native American tribes, their reservations still lie on the periphery of the national park. The wisdom, the knowledge, the connection that they have to the landscape itself is encoded in their language, their culture, and their traditions. The relationship they have with it remains intact, alive, and vital. They continue not just to simply tell stories about it, but to go into the park to perform rituals and ceremonies, to tell their children about it. And an awareness of these people, their presence on the land, their knowledge of it, the history to which they've been subjected, the injustices that have been done to them, all of these are like the existing layers of rock. They add another layer of richness and meaning and insight and challenge and provocation on top of the land itself. And therefore, it's an essential part of experiencing this landscape to learn about these people and to familiarize oneself, as I failed to do initially and came to do eventually, with their stories.
Kevin, you've been a senior editor at Outside Magazine. Your writings have appeared in such places like Esquire, National Geographic Adventure, and the New York Times. What's next?
A really long hiatus. I was 50 years old when I completed the walk through the park with Pete McBride. At the time, I didn't think anything could be more brutal or difficult than making our way on foot through the canyon. And then I spent 7 years writing this book, which was even harder than the journey itself. And I made a lot of sacrifices, as many, many writers do, time stolen from the people I love, from my family, from my wife, from my kids. And I need to spend time with them. I need to reconnect with them. And I need to allow the book to make its own way through the world so that people can judge for themselves what they think of it, whether it has value, and what it might have to offer.
Kevin Fedarko, he's written A Walk in the Park. It's more than a tale of adventure. It's really a story of resilience and the power of nature and the indomitable human spirit. It truly is thought-provoking, and I believe it offers readers a glimpse into the profound impact, like Kevin talked about places like the Grand Canyon. Kevin, best wishes.
Craig, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for your conversation and your questions.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Coming after the break, Danielle Webster reflects on holiday traditions and her great-grandma Maud's famous butterscotch pie, and Matt Olien shares his picks for the best and not-so-great movies of 2024. Stay with us on Main Street.
Bush Foundation is proud to partner with Strengthen ND to announce Bush Prize North Dakota winners. The Bush Prize is an annual award that celebrates organizations that are highly valued within their communities and have a strong track record of successful community problem solving. The 2024 Bush Prize North Dakota winners are North Dakota Native Vote and North Dakota Assistive. More information about the winners and the Bush Prize is online at bushfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We all have family traditions that hold a special place in our hearts this time of year, and Prairie Public's Danielle Webster shares a touching story about her family's cherished holiday rituals, the legacy of her great-grandma Maud's butterscotch pie, and the way food connects generations in the Upper Great Plains.
Family traditions are woven through holiday gatherings year after year. And for many of us in the Upper Great Plains, a lot of tradition shows up on our plates. In my family, it's in a slice of pie. Growing up, I ate a lot of lefse, sugar cookies, and mashed potatoes and gravy during the holidays. Trays of treats were placed on the counter to easily grab from as you walked by, and there were always smoked oysters with crackers off to the side because my grandpa liked them. But pie was extra special. My mother grew up in Southern California and worked at a restaurant called Richard's House of Pies. She admired how beautiful the pastries looked and tasted. Her favorite was pecan pie a la mode. When she met my dad and moved to North Dakota, he told her his favorite dessert was pie, so she became inspired. She cracked open the Better Homes and Gardens cookbook and got very good at making pies from scratch. And so this, especially, became an important edible tradition during the holidays. After all, nothing is better than a chilled slice of pumpkin pie with a pile of Cool Whip on top. When I got married, I wanted to carry on that tradition too, so I started bringing pies I baked to my in-laws for the holidays. At Thanksgiving and Christmas, I proudly presented pumpkin, pecan, and berry crumble pies, and of course the all-American apple pie would show up for the 4th of July. But there's one pie recipe I've sat on for years now, one I've actually heard about my entire life, and I think it's time I finally gave it a shot. It's a recipe for butterscotch pie, and this moment is just over 90 years in the making. My Webster side of the family originated in Scotland and ended up in Ramsey County, North Dakota. My dad's dad, Wilton, or Wilt, was a third-generation farmer in the region, but before that, he had to grow up during the Dust Bowl and Great Depression. Bringing in a crop in those days was difficult, to say the least. In 1934, Wilt was just 4 years old, and an historic day was approaching. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt was making a stop in Devil's Lake during a tour to see Dust Bowl hardships firsthand and offer some words of encouragement and optimism.
But I had a hunch, and it was the right one. When I got out here, I'd find that you people had your chins out.
Wilt's family was hardy and resourceful, but also very poor. There was enough gas in the car to get to town, but not enough to make it back. And so they resigned themselves to the fact that they just wouldn't be able to go. But on the day of the visit, a check for $2 arrived in the mail. That's $45 in today's money. My great-grandma Maud had submitted a recipe into a contest sponsored by the Farmer magazine. They informed her they would be publishing her recipe, and this was her monetary prize. The family now could afford to make the trip to town, and so my grandpa and his family piled into their 1928 Studebaker and hit the road just in time to join 35,000 other North Dakotans to see FDR and hear his message of hope, all because of that recipe for butterscotch pie. I mean, I have to taste this pie. It's time to break out the flour and sugar. To make great-grandma Maud's butterscotch pie, I combined a cup of brown sugar, a couple tablespoons of cornstarch, a bit of salt, and a couple cups of milk in a glass bowl. The recipe says, may use a double boiler, so I did. You're supposed to keep stirring until thick, so I kept whisking and whisking to no avail.
I am just moments away from abandoning this entire double boiler nonsense because this is not going to thicken. It's been like 40 minutes.
I thought maybe adding the butter and separated egg yolks would help, but it just wasn't setting up. I finally dumped in more cornstarch, but after 45 minutes, I gave up and started over.
Yeah, this is just not, I don't believe in this. Okay, we're gonna do something else.
This time, I skipped that double boiler business.
Wow. Oh my gosh. Okay, yeah, this looks really good.
Now the recipe says to pour the thickened filling into a baked pie crust. But anytime I've pre-baked a pie crust, it came out so tough you could barely eat it. So I rolled out a single crust, placed it into my pie dish, and used a spatula to scoop in the filling. For the topping, you just beat the separated egg whites until stiff, combined with 2 cups of small marshmallows, and spread over the top.
I'm confident we can get this topping done without any drama. Let's see here. I think it will be okay. All right. Okay. She's ready to go in the oven. As soon as it's done getting hot enough. Oh boy. Okay.
Now here's where I got into some more trouble. Maud's recipe says to bake at 350 degrees, but not for exactly how long. Because the filling is already cooked on the stove, it doesn't need to bake in the oven for an hour. All her recipe says is to bake till delicately brown. It was about now I started thinking, I definitely should have pre-baked that pie crust. I also should have Googled butterscotch pie before doing absolutely anything. There is no way a crust is going to be done after only 10 minutes.
But so like it's meringue, but it's also marshmallows.
Yeah.
So.
It's got that toasted marshmallow look. It looks perfect, golden brown.
Okay. We're gonna.
I think you're good.
Okay.
Follow the instructions.
Yeah.
It came out a little more toasty than delicately brown, but I felt okay about it. It didn't look like I could spill the entire pie, and that's what I was most concerned about. And now, to my in-laws' house we go.
Looks wonderful, Mom.
Oh, my.
Okay, I need a plate.
Andy, once again, you've
right
done yourself.
Turkey.
Yep.
There's two. There's one by you, too.
My husband's family has Thanksgiving traditions of their own. Candy's mashed potatoes, Gary's mom's dressing, an additional set of turkey breasts to accommodate the large family, and lots of gravy. For many attendees, multiple platefuls are heaped, and I'm starting to wonder if anyone will have room for pie at all. But to my delight, and let's be honest, anxiety, everyone is game.
Looking good.
Does it? This is very concerning.
When Candy cut into the pie, I started panicking. It looked a little soupy in the middle. But those fears subsided once slices were plated and passed around the table. The filling was a touch runnier than I'd hoped, but certainly not a disaster. And the reviews were glowing.
That's really good.
It does smell good. I don't know why.
Anyone else need a piece?
And it's not like you'd expect it to be just like super butterscotch.
Really?
But it's just a nice blend.
You want out?
I could feel that it was like a toasted marshmallow on
top. Yeah.
I think it's delicious.
Delicious.
I like it. I do too.
I can taste the scotch.
I really like it.
I can taste the butter.
I've decided to make this pie again for Christmas. My parents, sisters, and their families absolutely need to taste it. If you want to make Great Grandma Maud's butterscotch pie, here's a few tips. Skip the double boiler altogether and cook the filling directly on the stove. I plan to cook it a little longer next time to see if I can thicken it even more. And definitely pre-bake your pie crust. Use some pie weights so it doesn't bubble up. 15 minutes is all you should need. Great Grandma Maud passed away in 1992 when I was 8. This year, I was lucky enough to hear her voice again as she recalled a treasured memory from Christmas past.
Well, then all of a sudden, they told everybody to be quiet, and you could hear the sleigh bells ringing. And here comes Santa Claus through the kitchen window. And oh, I just couldn't get over it. I thought it was the most wonderful thing I'd ever seen. That's one Christmas I always remember.
When FDR visited Devil's Lake in 1934, one of the things he said was this. Quoting now, "We hope that nature is going to open the heavens. When I came out on the platform this morning and saw a rather dark cloud, I said to myself, maybe it is going to rain. Well, it did not. All I can say is, I hope to goodness it is going to rain. Good and plenty." End quote. Well, if you know anything about Devil's Lake, you know those rains eventually came, creating a whole new set of problems for farmers in the region, and a whole different flavor of hope had to take hold. For the Websters in the Devil's Lake Basin, hope may have tasted a little like butterscotch. Whatever hope, tradition, or memories taste like at your holiday table, be sure to enjoy it and make the effort to share it with those you love most. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Wide open range, it's Christmas for cowboys and wide open plains.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Pleased to welcome into the Main Street studio, Matt Olien. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig.
Matt, of course, reviews movies each and every Thursday here on Main Street. And we wanted Matt to come back into the studio and review the entire year. Oftentimes, Matt tells us this may be the best film of the year, and another one comes along. It might also be the best year. So we're going to ask Matt to rank the top 10 films of the year, and we're going to start by me giving him a laundry list, and we're going to play a game of in or out, Matt. You can say that's in my list, it's out, and then we'll let you go through the top 10 from 10 to 1. All right, Matt, The Wild Robot.
That's in. Top 10 for sure. It's going to win the animated feature Oscar.
The Substance.
I didn't see it, but I want to see it.
Dune Part 2.
Yes, that's top 10 for sure.
The Brutalist.
Haven't seen it. I have a screener. I will have seen this in about a week or so, and we'll review it right here, Craig. But it's getting a lot of good buzz. It's a long movie, too. It's like 3.5 hours.
A Real Pain.
Just outside the top 10, I would say. I think Kieran Culkin's going to get an Oscar nomination, kind of playing the on-the-spectrum cousin in the movie.
A movie I think you're just looking at right now, Queer with Daniel Craig.
As we're doing this, I'm about halfway through it. I think Daniel Craig gets an Oscar nomination, his first one. Should have been nominated for Casino Royale as Bond in the first film, but James Bond actors don't get nominated until they move away from Bond. Liking it so far, I like the director's films, the director's work, Luca Guadagnino, who directs it.
Gladiator 2.
Just outside the top 10. It wasn't as good as the first one.
Conclave.
Definitely top 10, for sure.
A Complete Unknown.
For sure top 10. Chalamet wins the Oscar.
Challengers.
No, I thought it was overrated. I had a lot of friends that liked it. I didn't like it.
I would agree with you there.
Yeah.
Nora.
Loved it. Top 10 for sure. Director Sean Baker's film is going to be in the mix, I think, for Best Picture.
Wicked.
Definitely top 10. Yep, much better than I thought it would be. It's heading for a lot of Oscars, I think.
All right, Matt, in no certain order, let's have your top 10 movies of the year.
I named a few of them already, so Wicked for sure, A Complete Unknown, Emilia Perez, Anora, Conclave, The Wild Robot, Dune Part 2, Long Legs, the horror film from this summer. I would also put I Saw the TV Glow in there, and Dee Dee. Now, again, to be determined, Nosferatu, The Brutalist, Queer, and Sing Sing are right on that. Baby Girl as well. Those are ones I'll have seen in the next 2 to 3 weeks probably, and certainly a few of those could slip in there. And the worst film of the year, can I tell you the worst film of the year?
It's not. I know this one. I just
not
know
even
you. Go
close.
Ahead.
It's not even close. Horizon, An American Saga, Chapter 1, Kevin Costner's folly, his disaster. It was so bad and so poorly received that they pulled Part 2 out of theaters. Part 2 was supposed to hit in August. It never got there. This was supposed to be a 4-part epic Western. It is horrible. It's going to win Razzies. The screenplay is a mess. The stories and the plots, it jumps around from character to character. You can't tell if you're supposed to focus on one character or the one next to them in the scene. It is an absolute mess. Shouldn't have been allowed.
Matt, if you had to pick maybe the top three and rank them in order of the movies that you just gave to me, what do you think you might tell me?
I think it's Conclave, Anora, and maybe A Complete Unknown. That's probably my top three. Emilia Perez is right in there as well. Wild Robot is really a good animated film, too. But I like long legs too.
Lots to like this year, it seems to me, in movies. Has this been a great year for movies, Matt?
I think it's going to be slightly less than 2023. 2023 last year was the comeback year. We've talked about this, Craig. The COVID years of 2020, 2021, and 2022 produced these Best Picture winners: Nomadland, Coda, and Everything Everywhere All at Once. None of those films would have won Best Picture had they been released in 2019 or 2023, in my opinion. Last year, we kind of got back to really a solid year. The holdovers: Oppenheimer, Barbie, Poor Things. And 2024, I think, is going to be a strong year. Maybe not quite as strong as 23, but we're past COVID now. We're past the actor strike. And so they're churning out good stuff. You know, it's great to see a movie like Queer with Daniel Craig stretching his acting chops. The Brutalist with Adrian Brody, which I'll see soon. So we're getting some really out there films in terms of artistic films that might not be box office films, like The Brutalist. Who's going to go to a 3.5-hour movie about a Jewish refugee who's an architect living in Pennsylvania? I would, but it's a hard sell for the general public out there. So I think we're back on solid ground. And just a shout out to, you know, I know a lot of people, as they age, kind of check out of movies. They stop going to movies. I have so many friends that have transitioned into watching streaming. They never go to the theater anymore. Some of these are young people too. And I think COVID changed viewing habits, Craig, a lot. It changed a lot of people in terms of becoming, I'm not making a criticism here, but they become homebodies. So people don't go to the theaters. But when you get the right film out there like Wicked and Gladiator 2, the Glicked weekend, it hits big. And so I do think A Complete Unknown and Nosferatu, which are both, you know, as we're talking about this, they have been released on Christmas Day. I think those are going to do very well at the box office. I think the Bob Dylan film is something that people will go to, even if they don't care for Bob Dylan. We have the Minnesota angle here, of course, with him. So I would encourage people to get out of your comfort zone and go to a movie. You may love the old movies and you're sick of the new movies, but a lot of people that I hear talk about, oh, there hasn't been a good movie made in years, don't go to movies. So how can you say that if you're not going to movies? There's still a magic to going to the theater. In 2024, Craig, I saw The Godfather and Lawrence of Arabia, both on the big screen. There's nothing like it. There's nothing like those gunshots in Godfather with that sound, or the desert in Lawrence of Arabia. So just give it a shot. Go to a movie. Maybe Wicked is your kind of movie. Maybe the Bob Dylan movie.
Matt, has Hollywood come to terms with streaming and movie theaters, do you think?
I think it's still a struggle. We've seen the end of the comic book film, I think. Not the end of it, but we've seen that first iteration of Marvel movies that ended with Avengers Endgame. And Marvel has not quite been able to kind of recapture the magic now that Captain America and Iron Man are out of the picture. So I still think they're wrestling with what does the public want to see. I can tell you this. I don't think the public is interested. And we had a show on this, Craig, before you became host of Main Street. Greg Carlson and I talked about this. For some reason, people are hesitant since COVID. I'm judging this anecdotally. I don't have stats on this. I don't have anything. For some reason, people do not want to go to the theater and watch something like Licorice Pizza or The Power of the Dog, something or Poor Things that might be a little out there, might have some characters they don't like, but they're completely willing to sit in front of a TV set and binge watch TV shows with people that are horrible characters. I try to come to grips with that. Why are people okay watching Breaking Bad, great TV show, right? Or other TV shows which have characters doing bad things. Why are they okay with that, but they won't go to the theater to watch it? My theory is they're spending money. They're going to the theater. They want something happy. They don't want Power of the Dog. They don't want Poor Things. They did go to Oppenheimer because of the Barbie connection. That's my theory, is if they're going to go out in public, go to the theater, spend $7, $8, $10, let's say $35 once you buy the popcorn and the pop, they don't want to see Benedict Cumberbatch as this rancher in Montana in Power of the Dog. And for some reason, they're okay watching Brian Cox and other actors on television playing really reprehensible characters. So that's an interesting thing that I've noticed since COVID. Whereas back when I was starting to go to movies in the 70s, Craig, people went to artistic films like The Godfather and Network and Apocalypse Now. And now it's a harder sell for theatergoers to go see a movie like that. They want Wicked. They want Moana 2. They want Inside Out 2, something happy.
Let me throw this at you, Matt. We've got about a minute left here as we talk about movies in 2024. We've invested a lot in a nice theater for our home. We've got a 120-inch screen.
Wow.
We've got great surround sound.
How come I haven't been over yet?
4K in our projector. And it's just really nice and comfortable. We also go to movies.
Yep.
But we've made it comfortable at home. And I think the NFL is also dealing with this. It's so comfortable to watch a football game. The technology is so much better now. Is that maybe part of it too?
I do think it's part of it. If people have invested in home theaters, there's no reason to leave the living room. I like to go to the theater. I would much rather see a movie on a theater than on my phone or my tablet. And it tends to be more of a younger person thing where younger people are used to watching things on their phones. And I'm not here to make a generational judgment or argument or anything like that. It's just I was raised differently. It was a big deal when my dad took me to the Deer Hunter and Apocalypse Now because I was 14 and I couldn't get in without him. And he knew I wanted to see them. Those are great memories. The Shining. We drove down to Aberdeen, South Dakota to see The Shining, me and my mom and dad. Those are great memories for me. And yet, when I think about watching a movie at home, I don't have that same memory, right? But other people do. But yet, I do think that's part of it. Hollywood is still wrestling with this. They're wrestling with, you know, a movie that goes straight to Netflix or straight to Hulu. How do they combat that? They combat that with something like Wicked and Nosferatu at the big theater, Gladiator 2, that needs to be seen on a big screen. And for the most part, I think people do come out, but they're not coming out quite like they used to.
Matt Olien, he visits with us each and every week in his weekly movie review. Matt, I appreciate that you take the time to visit with us. People may not know this isn't your main job at Prairie Public.
It isn't.
You just do it as a great favor to our listeners, and I'm thankful for that. Matt, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
You too, Craig.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 23rd. The 20th century was a time of rapid change. Americans were beginning to take to the roads in their automobiles, and daring young men and women were taking to the skies in their flying machines. Advances like the phonograph came fast and furious, and talking motion pictures and the radio were just around the corner. But some people had a difficult time adjusting to the fast pace of societal changes. John Dundon, a McKenzie County farmer, had a plan. He was quite sure that when the railroad came through the county, he would enjoy a windfall. He planned to sell the right-of-way across his land for a tidy sum. But the railroad didn't come, and Dundon thought he had identified the problem. He became convinced that airships were flying over his farm, discouraging the railroad from buying his land. The more he thought about the airships, the angrier he got. He even took to throwing axes at the imaginary aircraft, but was unable to bring one down. When the axe proved ineffective, Dundon began shooting at the aircraft. Dundon's neighbors grew concerned and approached the local authorities. Deputy Sheriff Shepard arrived to transport Dundon to the asylum at Jamestown. Dundon claimed that James J. Hill was behind the scheme to cheat him out of the sale of his right-of-way. He said Hill was sending the airship after him. After managing to escape from the asylum, Dundon made his way back home. He was not free for long. He was captured on this date in 1909, just 2 days after his escape. He continued to insist that no matter where he went, James J. Hill sent the airship after him. He was returned to the asylum and placed in treatment. Dundon continued to claim that there was a conspiracy against him and said he was being held in the asylum to cheat him out of his claim. The public's fascination with Dundon gradually faded, and his name disappeared from the newspapers. Still, many Americans could sympathize with his difficulty adjusting to the major societal changes spurred by technological innovations, and social movements like women's suffrage. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that wraps up this edition of Main Street. We'll have special holiday programming in this time slot on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, but we'll be back on Thursday with more stories and conversations. From all of us at Prairie Public, we wish you a happy holiday season filled with warmth, joy, and love.